Welcome to Module 9, where we're looking at functional medicine, mindfulness, and mold illness. Mold illness is a very big problem, and mold illness is affecting possibly up to about a quarter of the population. Basically, what mold illness is a genetic condition where people have a change, they have a certain HLA haplotype that we will talk about, and that particular HLA genetic makeup basically makes their immune system unable to recognize the toxins that are secreted from certain toxic molds. So people with this genetic makeup, when they go into a moldy building, what will happen is their immune system does not recognize those toxins from the mold, and those toxins therefore accumulate in their body at a very rapid rate. So 24% of individuals have the genetic anomaly, making them predisposed for this particular illness to occur. It's important to realize, of course, that just because we have these genes does not mean we have the disease. So while about a quarter of the population is genetically predisposed for this, this does not mean a quarter of the population actually is dealing with this, because we know that more than genes are the epigenetic expression of genes making somebody potentially set up for having an illness such as this. It's also important to realize that it's estimated that 1 out of 2, so 50% of American homes, are water damaged. This is really important because in areas where we do not have a lot of moisture, it can be hard for people to think about mold illness. So people sometimes think about mold when we're talking about New Orleans or the Pacific Northwest, these areas that are really damp and full of a lot of moisture. But the problem is with houses and with buildings is we are becoming more and more ecologically conscious, basically meaning we are building structures in a way where we are not allowing drafts to come in, drafts to go out. So this becomes very energy efficient. The problem with this from a biological perspective is when there's a tiny bit of moisture somewhere in the house, without the draftiness to dry things out, mold can grow really quickly. It's also apparent that mold is likely to easily grow in areas such as bathrooms. A lot of people do not use their fans in bathrooms, and a lot of bathrooms in poorly constructed houses will have exposed drywall, for example, over the shower. Drywall and the gypsum that makes up drywall is amazing food for mold. And so exposed drywall to moisture can quickly develop a mold problem. So just because somebody isn't in a moldy environment as far, or a wet, damp environment as far as the climate, does not mean that their house is safe of mold. We are in Colorado, is where we live and where our practice is, and it is unbelievable how many houses we find mold in. And even though we're in the super dry climate, we find mold in almost every house we test. Now, of course, we're only testing houses in people that we are suspecting mold illness in, but about 75% of the houses that we test turn out to have a significant mold problem, even here in the dry state of Colorado. So in this module, what we're doing in module 9 is we're talking a little bit more about CIRS, chronic inflammatory response syndrome, and mold illness. We're talking about the symptoms of mold illness, and we're differentiating them between mold and Lyme. We're going to talk about what tests to do for mold illness. We're going to talk about MARCONS, which is multiple antibiotic resistant coagulase negative staph, and its relationship to mold. We're going to talk about treatment of mold illness and MARCONS, how to work with the homes for mold, prevention of recurrence of mold illness, and the mental emotional impact of mold illness. So that's what we're doing in this module. So starting us off here with part one, lesson one, what is CIRS and mold illness? So chronic inflammatory response syndrome occurs when there's genetic susceptibility and people with these genetics are exposed to certain biotoxins. So the biotoxins in chronic inflammatory response syndrome technically can be from mold, they could be from Lyme, could be from other biological toxins that enter our body. So as we look later on in this particular module, we will actually learn about testing to determine genetically susceptible individuals. So some people will see in testing are genetically susceptible to mold, and so and only mold. And so chronic inflammatory response syndrome would just occur when they are in a moldy building and their gene is being expressed and they can't actually identify those mold toxins and get rid of them. We'll see later in the module when we look at this testing, we will see that some people have genes where they are multi-susceptible. And the multi-susceptible genes basically mean that the immune system of these people have a hard time tagging toxins, not just from mold, but from Lyme and from other toxins that exist in our current culture and society. So biotoxins also can be, they're really common to come from blue-green algae. So it's another big source. And as I said, the problem with the HLA genetics is that toxins are not appropriately tagged and therefore not appropriately removed by the immune system. So another question that's important is, can somebody have chronic inflammatory response syndrome without having this genetic makeup? And it is estimated about 5% of those who are sick from some of these biotoxins do not actually have the genetic makeup. So it can occur, but most of the time, 95% of the time, if people have chronic inflammatory response syndrome, it is because in part they have the genes and the genes are expressed. Another thing that's really, really important to understand is when we're talking about mold illness, when we're talking about chronic inflammatory response syndrome in relationship to mold, we are not talking about an allergy to mold. So an allergy to mold is just like what it sounds. It's truly when we have an IgE related response. So just like an allergy to pollen or to grass or to trees, whatever it is, those types of allergies are when we have an IgE mediated response and we have a histamine type of release. So that's not what we're talking here with mold illness. Mold illness, typically we're not going to see allergy type of symptoms that go with it unless people have an allergy to mold in addition to having this genetic problem. So sometimes we'll see people that live in the same household, and one person may be affected by the mold in an allergy related way, and they might have allergy related symptoms and they think it's just from outdoor allergens, and it's actually because they are actually living in a toxic allergenic type of environment. And another member of the household might not experience those symptoms at all, but it might have more mold related symptoms that we'll get into later. So that can be very confusing to people, and people can be sometimes very resistant to the possibilities of testing their house, thinking that, well, if the house is sick, then why does everybody in the house experience different symptoms? And it's just because of their genetics and how they are responding to mold. Of course, we can also have situations where the house is sick and one person has CIRS type of symptoms and nobody has any other response at all. And so the house is making one person sick, but the rest of the residents are actually not sick. And so this is why it's super important to understand the mechanism, because one of the things that we'll teach in this module is it's really, really pretty impossible to get somebody well with CIRS if they are still living in the place that's making them sick. And so testing the house or testing the work, testing where they spend a lot of time is extremely important. And it's important to understand how to explain this to somebody, because I can pretty much guarantee that one thing you will have come up in your clinical practice when you're trying to work with this is going to be people that are not wanting to test their house because they don't want to spend the money, and they say, well, I don't understand how it could be a problem with my house because not everybody in my house is sick. So it's important to understand how to explain the difference between allergies and genetics, and explain that some people have this genetic makeup, and if others don't, they could actually be well in the same environment that somebody else is sick. So some statistics on water damaged buildings. So as I mentioned earlier, 1 in 2 American homes are water damaged. Schools and churches are notorious for mold. Schools and churches oftentimes are built in a way where there's a lot of leaks. They're not always having the funds to fix things well or quickly. And so it's very, very likely if people are working in these types of environments that they could be exposed to mold. Dry climates do not mean mold is less. New construction does not mean mold is less either. Think about this. If like construction materials were really not cared for, and they sat out in the rain and they didn't dry out properly, and then they were used in the house before they were totally dry, they could actually be, you know, building new buildings with moldy parts. Also, like I mentioned, this whole fan thing in the bathroom, if people are not using their fan very well, and all of a sudden the bathroom is not being dried, as soon as somebody moves into a new place, if the bathroom's not being used correctly and that fan's not being used correctly and there's exposed drywall, mold could develop very, very, very quickly, and we might think that we're fine just because it's new. Basements, attics, and crawl spaces are notorious also for mold. Crawl spaces aren't really a problem if the air is not shared with the house. So if the crawl space is truly not combining air with the house, then even if the crawl space is moldy, that's likely going to be fine. Now, the problem is oftentimes crawl spaces will share some of the same air as the house. And in that case, while the mold is living in the crawl space, the spores and the toxins from the mold could be traveling into the house, making the house sick. Carpeting is going to have more likelihood to house moisture than something like hardwood. And then, of course, architectural design. So a few things about the architectural design of the house. We want the awning outside the house to be about 1.5 feet away from the house, which means is when there's rain, the rain runs off of the roof and onto the ground, onto the earth, significantly away from the house, versus if there's these very short awnings, which you see all over the country, just a couple inches. And what happens then is the rainwater then, when it rains, it dumps off the side of the roof next to the house. And if there's enough water next to the house, it can start seeping into the house and cause mold that way. So we really also want to look for architecturally when there's a slope, that where the high side of the slope is. So if it's sloped towards the house, that is clearly going to cause a problem with drainage going and water possibly going up through the house and the foundation. We want to make sure the siding and the roof has really good integrity. And we also want to look for integrity of the seals and windows and condensation around them. So if anybody is thinking about buying a house and your patients, your clients are thinking about buying a house, a great thing to tell them if we're concerned about mold is go look at the house, see if you can time it with a recent rain if possible, and see if that's possible to time it. Look for the integrity of the seals and windows. Is there condensation around the windows? If there's condensation around the windows, then there's moisture actually getting inside around the windows, and that could be causing a mold problem. And then, of course, the proper bathroom venting and use. So the use as far as the fan I discussed, but the other component of this that's really important is where does that vent go? So if we have venting in the bathroom, I've heard of stories, for example, where the bathroom vent is actually going into the attic. And what that means is that moisture from the bathroom is hitting the same spot in the attic over and over and over again. In this particular instance, it caused the mold problem in the attic. So where is that vent going? Is that vent properly going outside? These are really, really important questions to consider for our mold-sensitive clients in both renting and in purchasing a house. So also, it's important to realize that with the ERMI is one of the tests we're going to look at to actually determine if the house or the building is moldy. So we'll go over that in the testing module. And it's really important to know that there is a study that really looked at the humidity levels, and the humidity levels of the house do not adequately tell or predict if there's truly a mold problem. So sometimes they can be pointers, but it's really important to realize this, and we'll look at this more later, that just going around with humidity meter and saying, oh, the humidity is, you know, at the right percentage, that doesn't actually adequately predict if there's mold there. So we'll look at that more in the testing section. How quickly does mold grow? So mold after a leak, within 48 hours of a leak starting, if the leak is not stopped and cleaned up, mold can start growing. So some of the molds that are rapidly growing include Aspergillus and Penicillium. So these two molds can grow very, very quickly. So it can be as something as like, wow, a leak started on Wednesday under the sink, and you know, and we didn't want to turn our water off, and the plumber can't get there till Saturday, and so there's just this slow leak, and we're just have this bucket under our sink, and we have this situation where there's moisture building. That can be enough that quickly to start mold growing. So we really need to be take leaks very, very seriously. Now, Stachybotrys is otherwise known as black mold. Stachybotrys requires an ongoing water source of 2+ weeks. So when we had some floods here in Colorado about five or six years ago, I guess that it was now, there was a lot of water damaged buildings, and there was a huge amount of water everywhere with all the rivers so high, and there was a lot of Stachybotrys growing in buildings, and a lot of buildings that are now really sick because of the results of that floods, because that water source was continual, just feeding that Stachybotrys. Chaetomonium is another one that is a pretty toxic mold, and this one also requires an ongoing water source, just like Stachybotrys. So the point of understanding this is realizing some people think that oh, they fix things fairly quickly, they're fine. It's really important to realize that some of these molds grow very, very rapidly. And so seeing a leak, it's really important to take very major precautions to make sure that we are not allowing these molds to grow. So aflatoxins are toxins found in several different species of mold. So Aspergillus, various species of Penicillium, Rhizospas, Mucor and Streptomyces all will produce aflatoxins. Aflatoxins are commonly known because they are also seen in peanuts. They're considered one of the most abundant, most toxic, and potent naturally occurring carcinogenic substances known, and actually have been shown to be one of the leading causes of liver cancer in many developing countries. So aflatoxins are very important to be aware of. They can cross the blood-brain barrier, they can affect the brain cells, the mitochondria, and our DNA. We see them in peanuts, but we also see them in corn and rice and grains and wheat and barley and milk. So this can be one reason why some people with mold illness really do well not being on a lot of grains, because of the possibility of the aflatoxin contamination. So temperature-wise, anything that's higher than 37 degrees Celsius can increase aflatoxin production. So when we're in a situation where we have some of these molds, such as the Aspergillus and Penicillium, present, and they're repopulating, if we had combined that with a hot temperature, that will also increase aflatoxins. Ochratoxin A is another common mycotoxin. Ochratoxin A is found in all of these different molds: Aspergillus, Penicillium, Petromyces, Neopetromyces. So all of these different species will contain ochratoxin. Ochratoxin is nephrotoxic. It's toxic to our genes, it's toxic to our immune system, and it's neurotoxic. It is a known carcinogen in animals, and it's possibly a human carcinogen. So very, very toxic to many different systems within our body. In foods, we find ochratoxin in dried fruit, in wine, in wheat, in rye, in barley, olives, buckwheat, dried vegetables, and coffee. So when we talk about mold-free coffee, one, which is, you know, getting more and more popular in the biohacker movement, one of the big toxins we're worried about in coffee is ochratoxin A. Gliotoxin is a toxin found in Aspergillus, and it's also found in Candida. So we've talked, of course, in the GI module about Candida, and I know you all are very aware of Candida. And from a mycotoxin perspective, one of the things we're worried about with Candida, as well as Aspergillus, is gliotoxin. So gliotoxin will inactivate neutrophils and phagocytes. In fact, this is how Candida tends to overpopulate, in part, is by releasing this particular toxin that's going to turn down our neutrophilic and phagocytic activity to actually fight the Candida. It's also going to attack our nerve cells. So the astrocytes and oligodendrocytes will be affected. Nervous system symptoms are therefore likely to be produced. And in research, we see skin, lung, liver, and kidneys being affected by gliotoxin. Stachybotrys is the black mold that produces the mycotoxin trichothecenes. This is one of the most toxic mycotoxins out there. It's nephrotoxic, genotoxic, immunotoxic, neurotoxic. It's also a possible human carcinogen, and it's considered extremely toxic, and it's actually been used also as a biological warfare agent. It's that level of toxic. So much of the toxicity is thought to result from the inhibition of protein synthesis. So of course you get massive degradation of the body when we cannot synthesize proteins. Because of that, we get multi-organ effects, including emesis and diarrhea, weight loss, nervous disorders, cardiovascular alterations, immunodepression, bone marrow damage, hemostatic derangement, skin toxicity, decreased reproductive capacity. All of these things can come from trichothecenes. So that's basically the nitty-gritty, so to speak, of what CIRS is. To kind of sum that up, some of the important things to remember are, one, the genetic component is almost always present in people that have mold illness. But it is possible for people to have mold illness without it. Two, it is really important to make sure people are in a safe environment if they have this, that we cannot get them well if they're not in that safe environment. Three, it's really important to realize that allergies are different than mold illness. Mold illness is a different mechanism than a mold allergy. And four, it's really important to understand that these toxins are very severe in these people with these genetic disorders. And we're going to talk more about all these symptoms, but we're talking about multi-systemic major effects from the toxins that are affecting these bodies. So more of that to come in part two, coming up, symptoms of mold illness. We'll see you then.